Viruses affect all life on Earth, and humans cannot be separated from the natural world or from the diseases that are part of nature. In this Bozeman Library Community Forum, with moderator Paula Beswick, distinguished science writer David Quammen discusses the factors responsible for the COVID-19 pandemic, its origins, how it spread from animals to humans and back again, and what the future may hold. His talk was followed by a lively Q&A. Immediately following that, Mike Maltavern, Deputy Chief of Operations for the Bozeman Fire Department, and Patrick Lonergan, Chief of Emergency Management and Fire in Gallatin County, provided an update on local vaccinations and the process going forward. Recorded online on March 17, 2021.
As we sit 1 year into this devastating pandemic, science writer David Quammen will walk us through how we got here and where we are headed on a global scale. Immediately following David's presentation and question period, please stick around for the local perspective on the infection and vaccination process with Patrick Lonergan, Chief of Emergency Management and Fire in Gallatin County, and Mike Maltaverna, Deputy Chief for Bozeman Fire Department. They will provide current data and also take questions from you. So boys and girls, click on your seatbelts. We're in for a jam-packed program today. David Quammen, an American author and journalist, has written 16 books, including Song of the Dodo in 1996, which radically alters the way in which we understand the natural world and our place in that world. His most recent book, The Tangle Tree, explains how recent discoveries in molecular biology can change our understanding of evolution and life's history, with the powerful implications for human health and even our own human nature. But it's his 2012 book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, that is gripping all of us right now, with his descriptions of the dynamics of viral spillover from wildlife into humans and predicted a coming pandemic, possibly caused by a coronavirus. David, I'd like to say this was prescient, but I think it was probably just science.
That's right,
that you were able to bring to us, so thank you. David's magazine work has appeared in The New Yorker, National Geographic, Harper's, The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, and The New York Times Review of Books, among other magazines, and his op-eds in The New York Times and other newspapers. He's a three-time winner of the National Magazine Award and has received several awards for his books. And actually, I was just thinking this, David, you were our Library Cornerstone winner. David shares his home in Bozeman, Montana with wife Betsy Gaines Quammen, author of the book American Zion, God, Clive and Bundy, and the Public Lands in the West. And if those of you that joined us, you will remember her from our September 2020 program, which you'll sort of started all of this and what was very revealing back then. So we are honored to have you with us today, David, to round out the Quammen family. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you very much. And thanks to the library, the dear Bozeman Public Library, of which I am a great fan and to which I'm deeply indebted. 40 years ago, when I was a youngish, starving freelance writer living in Ennis, I used to come to Bozeman, and I had no library card for Montana State, and I would come to the Bozeman Public Library, and the dear people, the dear librarians at the Bozeman Public Library would order these obscure books for me through interlibrary loan. God bless them, Bozeman Public Library. Anyway, also thanks to the Library Community Forum, to you, Paula, Beth Boyson, our friend C.D. Happel, and the rest of the committee. Thank you for including me in this. This subject is like the Big Bang. It's exploding in every direction. There is information flying out. Each day that I spend sitting at my desk here reading scientific journal papers, I get 3 or 4 days farther behind on reading scientific journal papers about this. So to try and make sense of this in what seems like a remotely coherent linear way in 40 minutes or so, I'm going to talk to you about 4 questions, 5 words, and 3 rivers. That's my little mental structural guide to the various different things that I want to explore with you. So 4 questions. Where does this thing come from? this virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, that's the cause of what we call the disease, COVID-19. Where has it come from? What is it going to do? Will we ever be rid of it? And will there be more? Those are the four questions that I'll try and get to. The five words I will define are, Paula already mentioned one of them. The five words are zoonosis, spillover, reservoir host. That's two words that counts for one idea. Zoonosis, spillover, reservoir host, and outbreak. And three rivers. I'll get to what the three rivers are a little bit farther along. But to start with the questions first, where does this thing come from? Well, everything comes from somewhere, and dangerous new viruses, scary new viruses infecting the human population come from wild animals. We know that. We know that from science. Why is that so? Well, it's because viruses can only live and replicate in cellular creatures. Viruses are not cells. Viruses are just little capsules of genetic material, information molecules, inside a little protein capsule. The information molecule can be either DNA, the famous double helix, or RNA, which is a single-stranded molecule. Viruses attach themselves to the surface of cells, and then they inject their genetic material into the cell. So cellular creatures are animals, plants, fungi, bacteria. All of those are creatures composed of cells of greater or lesser complexity, but all of them much more complex than viruses. So viruses use cells by injecting their genetic information into the cell, and then they hijack the machinery of the cell to create more proteins, more copies of themselves, copies of their genome. They come busting out of the cell and in great numbers and go on to infect another cell. That's what viruses do. So we know that a new virus to humans had come from some sort of a cellular creature where it has been living inconspicuously, without causing symptoms, possibly for millions of years. Now, a virus that comes out of, for instance, an animal is more likely to be able to infect humans than a virus that comes out of a plant or a bacterium. We are animals, after all. And the viruses that infect humans mainly come from birds and mammals. The influenza viruses mostly come from wild aquatic birds, and the other viruses that are known to infect humans mostly come from mammals. We are mammals, after all. Now, nobody knows exactly how many viruses are out there in the natural world, but there are plenty. All of the wild creatures, the species of wild creatures that live in our forests, that live in our rivers, that live in our richly diverse ecosystems, they all carry viruses. They all carry viruses that are unique to them as a species, or perhaps to a group of species. Nobody knows how many in each species of wild animal, but I've seen estimates, which are just seat of the pants estimates, that there might be as many as 1.7 million unique forms of virus living just in wild birds and mammals. 1.7 million. And of those, again, by a very rough estimate, possibly 600,000 to 700,000 might be capable of infecting humans. So there's a lot out there. How do those viruses come in contact with humans? Well, they come in contact with humans because we come in contact with wild animals. We do things. We go into these wild, diverse ecosystems, and we disturb those ecosystems. We harvest those animals for food, or we capture them live. We cut down trees. We build timber camps. We build mining camps. And in doing all of that, we shake loose these viruses from their natural animal hosts. When a virus is shaken loose and passes from its non-human animal host into its first human victim, that moment is called spillover. That's why my book is titled Spillover. That's the key moment. The virus coming from its animal host into its very first human victim and taking hold there, finding that it can replicate. Spillover. If it takes hold and transmits from one human to another and causes disease, causes illness, then we call that a zoonotic disease. And that virus is a zoonosis, as in zoology, zoos, animals. So zoonoses are viruses or other pathogens that come from animals and can infect humans. The particular animal, the host, the species of animal in which a virus has been living before it gets into humans is what's called the reservoir or the reservoir host. As I've said, that's where the virus hides over a long period of time, keeping a low profile, not replicating rampantly, not causing disease in that population of animals, just living there as sort of a secure hideaway, a refuge. And then if it's jostled from that refuge and finds the opportunity to fall into another host, it's like a cluster of birds being blown offshore to an island, say a cluster of pigeons in a storm blown offshore to an island where there are no native species of pigeon. And if five pigeons are blown offshore and land on an island where there are no pigeons, and they find that there's fruit that they can eat, and they can lay their eggs in nests in the trees and multiply, then they've colonized that island. That's what a virus does. If it gets into a new host, it's like colonizing a new island. And if it's successful, that means it has succeeded in replicating itself and transmitting from one human to another. The population of humans is the new island of habitat for this creature. If the virus transmits from one human to another, causes disease and makes 20 people, 30 people sick in some remote village in Africa or a town in China or say on the Navajo reservation in the southwestern United States, then those 20 or 30 cases, we call that an outbreak. There's a disease outbreak. Some of you may remember in 1992, there was a mysterious, scary disease outbreak in the Four Corners area, including the Navajo reservation. It was eventually found to be a virus new to America or newly discovered, one of the Hanta viruses. This was the big, scary Hanta virus outbreak of 1993. So that is an outbreak. To go a little farther, if the outbreak spreads across a country, infecting thousands of people, we call that an epidemic. And if it gets to an international airport, spreads around the world, we call that a pandemic. So that brings us back to COVID-19. Let me say a little bit about where this particular zoonosis, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, seems to have come from. First of all, it was detected first simply as an atypical pneumonia, the symptoms, the disease syndromes, as you've heard, everybody's heard this, in the city of Wuhan in late December. A cluster of cases of atypical pneumonia. There was no evidence yet, at least the Chinese didn't release any evidence, that the Chinese government, that there was human-to-human transmission. But then rumors started to leak out that, yes, there seemed to be human-to-human transmission. That was scary to the disease scientists. And then in the first 10 days of 2020, several different teams of scientists managed to find a virus and sequence the genome of that virus. And the words novel coronavirus started to be spoken. This is a novel coronavirus, new to humans, a virus that belongs to the coronavirus family. That's when the disease scientists started to get really worried. And that's when I perked up. I saw the words novel coronavirus. And I thought, oh, okay, this could be bad. Why? Because coronaviruses are one of those groups of virus that have a capacity to evolve very quickly and to therefore adapt to new kinds of hosts. And they had a history of infecting humans, making humans very sick, killing humans. The history involved particularly the the original SARS outbreak in 2002 and 2003, a novel coronavirus got into humans, made people very sick, killed some in southern China, in the province of Guangdong. And then it spread to the city of Hong Kong, got into a hotel, the Metropole Hotel, in a Chinese doctor who was staying there for his nephew's wedding in Hong Kong. He had come from Guangdong. He got very ill and spread the virus, the original SARS virus, to other people who were staying in rooms on the ninth floor of the Metropole Hotel. Up and down the corridor, people got infected. Nobody knows exactly how. Did he sneeze? Did he cough? Did he vomit in the corridor? Nobody still knows. But people from that corridor got up in the morning, checked out of the hotel, ending their Hong Kong vacations, and flew back to Toronto, Bangkok. Some flew to Hanoi, Singapore, taking this new virus with them. And so there were outbreaks in these cities. It was very scary at the time, particularly to disease scientists who knew what was going on, because it was transmissible through the air on a cough or a sneeze. And it was killing a lot of healthcare workers. It killed 1 in 10 of the people that it infected, a very high case fatality rate. Not as high as Ebola, but maybe 100 times higher than a seasonal influenza. Eventually, it infected 8,000 people, killed 800 of them, and then it was stopped. It was contained by rigorous public health measures and fast diagnostic science. And the disease scientists breathed a sigh of relief. Whew, we dodged the big one there. Weren't we lucky in several ways? We were lucky that we caught it early, although it got to these cities. These cities had strong healthcare systems. They had strong governments. They were not chaotic cities. They were orderly cities like Toronto, Singapore, Hanoi. And we were very lucky because it did not have cryptic spread. It did not have asymptomatic spreaders. Oh, just imagine how worse it would have been if people had been walking around feeling healthy, going to work, riding the subway, and spreading this virus. Ah, weren't we lucky? Okay, that's 2003. It ends. Everybody goes back to sleep, except the disease scientists who continue saying, we need to be very careful about coronaviruses. They've been saying it since 2003. In 2005, a team of scientists who had been trying to discover the origin of this first SARS-CoV virus, they found a virus quite similar in bats in southern China. Horseshoe bats in particular in southern China. So they published a paper in 2005 saying, we've found a virus that's not identical to this SARS-1 virus, but it's quite similar, 92% similar, if I recall correctly, in terms of its genome. So that's a signal that this virus probably came from bats. We've also found this the exact same virus in civets, this kind of large badger-like animal that is a wild animal. The masked palm civet belongs to, if I recall correctly, the same family as mongooses, the viverrids, but larger than a mongoose. A wild animal that is farmed, raised, and marketed for food, or was then in southern China. And civets were found to be carrying a virus very similar to the SARS-1 virus. So there was a great slaughter of civets. There was a pogrom against civets. But then this team of scientists I'm talking about said, hey, wait a minute. We don't think that that virus originated in civets because there's very little genetic diversity of that virus in civet population, suggesting that it got into them recently. The virus hadn't had much of a chance to mutate and diverge within civets. But in horseshoe bats, we found a similar virus. We think it's the progenitor. It is a relative of this virus. And this virus probably originates in horseshoe bats and then was transmitted into civets for a short period of time because of the wild animal trade. and went from civets to humans, an amplifier host, an intermediate host. Okay, so that's 2005. One of the members of that team is a Chinese virologist, a woman named Zhengli Shi. She was on this original paper in 2005. She is based at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and you may have heard her name in the news in recent months. So Zhengli Shi went to work after that, focusing on the viruses that bats carry, and in particular, on the coronaviruses that bats carry. And what she found over the years was a great diversity of coronaviruses living in the great diversity of different species of horseshoe bats in southern China. And when she found new viruses, she would sequence the genome from samples, fecal samples. That's not to say that she was growing the virus. She was finding fragments of the genomes of viruses in these bat samples and putting those fragments together like jigsaw puzzles and assembling full genomes. And in 2013, she found a particular virus, a coronavirus, in a mine in the province of Yunnan, southern China. And eventually she gave that virus the code name RATG13, RATG13, okay? So fast forward, and she published that. She published that in 2016. She announced that here's a virus that I've found. And she said, this could be dangerous to humans. We should be alert to these coronaviruses in bats. They could be dangerous to humans. Zhengli Shi and her group published that. Okay, so January of last year, the virus genome of SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19's virus, is sequenced and it's immediately made public. It's put up on a website. So scientists all over the world can look at this genome and compare it with anything that they might know, they might find in public databases or whatever. And after that happened, Zhengli Shi spoke up, published a paper that said, ah, well, we have a virus that's 96% similar to this new COVID-19 virus. And we found it in a mine in 2013 in the province of Wuhan in a horseshoe bat. That strongly suggests that this virus, which is not identical to our virus, also probably came from a horseshoe bat, maybe in Yunnan. Well, what's it doing in the city of Wuhan? People have been proposing various different theories for that ever since. But this is what we know. Zhengli Shi published the genome of this virus back, this similar virus back in 2013. And now we find that it's a 96% match to this virus. Well, what does that mean, 96%? Does that mean it's the same virus? No. The rate at which coronaviruses evolve tells us that to become 4% different, two viruses would need to be isolated from each other and evolving, mutating separately for 40 or 50 years. So what does this look like then? Well, what it looks like is that there was a single population of bats that were infected with viruses, including a single population of the ancestor of the viruses we're talking about. Sometime 40 or 50 years ago, those two bat populations became isolated from each other, possibly by habitat destruction, possibly human settlement, or possibly they migrated to different places and started roosting in different caves. But they were separated for 40 or 50 years. And the viruses in them continued to mutate and evolve. Viruses always mutate, but they evolve if it helps them by natural selection to become different. So they gradually diverged from each other for 40 or 50 years so that they were 4% different, okay? And here is the population in that mine in Yunnan, and it contains RATG13, this virus that Dr. Zhengli Shi found. Somewhere else is the population of bats carrying a different virus by now, but we haven't found that yet. We don't know where that is. And so all we have is COVID-19 and its virus, SARS-CoV-2, and we know that it's 96% similar to this virus, but we don't know where this virus is. And scientists are looking for that now. and it's difficult to find the exact progenitor of a virus. There are lots of bats out there, there are many different species, there are lots of viruses in them. That work has to go on for us to know exactly where this virus came from. In the meantime, according to the principle that no good deed goes unpunished, Zheng Li Shi is now being accused of having leaked the COVID-19 virus from her laboratory. And you can find those accusations in the great febrile universe of social media. She's being accused of that. But she was the one who has been warning us for 16 years to beware of coronaviruses. Okay, so that's what we know about where this virus came from. What's it going to do? What is this virus going to do? Well, we know that it has colonized humans with great success. It has become one of the most successful viruses on the planet because of its ability to transmit from human to human and to do what SARS-1 was not able to do, to transmit from people who are asymptomatic. A very ingenious, nefarious virus. I'm personifying it. Viruses aren't really ingenious. They are merely very, very adaptive. Viruses obey what I think of as the three Darwinian imperatives. Any creatures that replicate themselves by way of genomes, replicate themselves by way of DNA or RNA, and mutate as they replicate themselves and evolve, are subject to the three Darwinian imperatives of evolution, of survival of the fittest. The first imperative is make as many copies of yourself as you can. Have as many children as possible. Lay as many eggs as you can. Raise as many images of yourself as you can. Proliferate abundantly. Second imperative is expand yourself in geographical space. Get to that island that has no pigeons on it and colonize it. So that's now pigeon distributional range. Get everywhere you can, spread out across the planet as much as you can. Colonize, colonize, colonize. That's the second Darwinian imperative. And the third Darwinian imperative is extend yourself in time. Avoid extinction, persist into the future. And if you, as this population of creatures subject to these Darwinian imperatives, if you effectively perform the first of those tasks, multiplying yourself as abundantly as possible, and the second of those challenges, expanding yourself in geographical space, then the chances are you will succeed at the third, extending yourself in time. You will avoid extinction because there are so many of you in so many different places that a single fire or a single destroyed forest or a single typhoon cannot wipe you out because you are in many different places living in many different ways, this successful population. So that's what this virus is doing. And that's what the Darwinian imperatives require it to do. It spent the first half of 2020 without evolving much. Scientists were sampling patients and sequencing genomes like never before. That's one of the things that's very new about this COVID-19 phenomenon. We have speedy automated genome sequencing as never before in the time of pandemic so that we can see how this virus is evolving day to day, sample by sample. How many mutations? Which mutations seem to be propagated? Which mutations tend to cluster with other mutations into what we call variants? And how are those variants succeeding? Well, for the first half of 2020, you didn't hear anything about variants, right? You didn't hear anything about this virus evolving, adapting. And scientists were saying, it's really not doing much. It's not changing much. It's mutating because viruses always mutate, but the mutations are just static or just noise, and there's no directionality as to which mutations are being preserved. So the virus is not evolving. Why is it not evolving? Anybody want to guess? Because it didn't have to. It was so successful. It was getting into every individual human that it needed to. It didn't have to change by evolution. It didn't have to adapt because it was already so well adapted. It came out of that bat, broadly adapted enough to infect not just humans, but also tigers, lions, mink. What else? Gorillas at the San Diego Zoo have become infected with it. It's a very versatile, broadly adapted virus that happens to be extremely well adapted to this particular kind of mammal, us. So it succeeded very well. And then beginning in September, things started to change. But we didn't hear about the changes until December, because it took scientists some time to continue sequencing genomes and to analyze what they were seeing. And then a group of scientists in England found that there was a particular cluster of mutations. These are identified with code words and letters, like E484K or N501Y. I might have that reversed. It's not important to know any of that, except each of those represents small mutations, or in some cases, larger mutations or deletions in the genome of this virus. In particular, these mutations were showing up in what's called the spike gene, which creates the spike protein on this virus. Now, you've seen artist renditions of this virus. It's this round thing, and it's got all these stobs sticking out of it. It's kind of like a ball of ham with cloves sticking out of it on all sides. And those cloves are the spike protein. And what they do is catch hold of hooks on the outside of cells. Certain kinds of cells have different kinds of hooks on their outside. The hooks are proteins that stick out from the interior of the cell. So those spikes take hold of hooks to allow them to attach to a cell that they're going to parasitize, and then also to merge with the cell membrane and inject their genome into the cell. That's what the spike protein does. Spike protein suddenly started changing back around September. And there were mutations that were showing up in the spike protein. And some of those mutations spread really effectively. And some of them became clustered into bouquets of mutations, whole packages of mutations. And those packages, which we call variants, spread. One spread from southeastern England up through London and then across England. And now it's spread across the world. We call that the UK variant. Fancy name is B117. And then scientists, again, sequencing genomes and looking at what they had, found another one that was coming out of South Africa. And then they found another one that was coming out of Brazil. Some of those variants, or some of the flowers in those bouquets that we call variants, some of the individual flowers were the same in the UK and the South African and the Brazilian, but some of them were different. So they had different originations, but now they're spreading across the world. And there is great concern that they will run ahead of our capacity to get people vaccinated. And perhaps they will be different enough from the quote unquote wild type genome of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the one that has been used in the development of our vaccines. There's concern that they will be different enough that the vaccines will not be fully effective, might not be effective at all. There's also concern that people who have been infected once and who've survived a case of COVID-19, instead of being immune to further reinfection, might be susceptible to reinfection because this version of SARS-CoV-2 is different enough from the one that infected them. All of this is going on. This is what I spend my days reading about and talking to scientists about. What's happening with the variants? What's happening is evolution by natural selection. What's happening is Darwin. Darwin guiding viruses to be as successful as they possibly can be. And it's a race. I don't want to say this is not Darwin's fault, by the way. He just described this. He was a wonderful man. You know, he didn't. This was not prescriptive. This was descriptive on the part of Charles Darwin. Social Darwinism is another matter. We won't get into that right now. So this is what's been happening. virus spreading around the world, in some cases mutating and then through natural selection of mutations, adapting to be resistant perhaps to vaccines, perhaps to natural immunity. How are we going to deal with that? Well, these vaccines can be modified. They can be tweaked. They can be updated. And so this is not anything to panic about, but it's something to take very seriously, be concerned about. And it's a reason why we need to support our scientists and science education and not be in denial about science and in denial about the advisories from public health. These people are talking about invisible things that are yet very, very real. They know they're real because they've seen the genomes, they've seen the diagnostic tests, and they know that this virus hasn't gone away. We're now fortunately going into a period where caseloads are going down, at least in some places in Montana, in the US, not in Italy. Italy just entered another lockdown. Italy is now in its third wave. And I talk to people in Italy all the time, and it's not a happy time in Italy for them. They're going bracing for this third lockdown and this third wave. The virus hasn't gone away, and it's not going to get away. So my third question was, will we ever be rid of it? Will we be rid of the COVID-19 pandemic? Will we be rid of social distancing? Will we be rid of the need to wear masks? Yes, we will be, I think. And the scientists, more importantly, the scientists that I listen to and trust think so. We will be. We aren't yet, but we will be. We're moving in the right direction, except in some places we're now moving in the wrong direction. As Tony Fauci said the other day, you don't spike the football on the 5-yard line. And that's what I think states such as Texas and Florida are doing. I hope I'm wrong. I hope Tony Fauci is wrong, but there's great danger that he's right and that we're celebrating too soon. But we will get through this. We'll get through the pandemic eventually. We'll get back to something resembling normal. And then what? Will the COVID-19 virus be gone? Will SARS-CoV be gone from the human population? No, it won't be. It's never going to be gone from the human population, I think, in my humble opinion, and based on the scientists that I trust and talk to. It's going to stay with us. I think 40 years from now, children will be vaccinated against COVID-19. And they'll probably say, what's COVID-19? Why does it have that 19 number after it? And then parents will tell their children, well, because once upon a time in 2020, we had a pandemic caused by a virus that emerged in 2019. Oh, really? No kidding. And so that's why we have to get this shot? Yes. Why? Well, didn't the virus go away? No, the virus is still here. So you need to get this shot to protect you from this dangerous virus, just the way you need to get still a measles shot 40 years from now. We've had a measles vaccine for 60 years. Is measles gone from planet Earth? No. 2 children died last week in Nigeria of measles. In 2019, I believe it was, 140,000 people around the world died of measles. Measles is not trivial. Measles is a serious disease. It's not a coronavirus, but it's another fast evolving virus, not as fast as coronavirus, but and an extremely transmissible virus. Actually, it's more an issue that it's highly transmissible than it's fast evolving in this case, because our vaccines have remained good for measles largely over that period of time. But we haven't gotten rid of it. We've never gotten it out of the human population. And the chances are that we'll never get this out of the human population either. Okay, so finally, my last question, will there be more? Yes. When we get to the end of the COVID-19 pandemic, when we can take off the masks, when we can fill the schools up again with children, when we can go to the stadiums and to the theaters and to the bars and restaurants, when we get to that point later this year or early next year, we should celebrate for 5 minutes, and then we should start planning for the next one, because there will be a next one. There are many, many more coronaviruses out there. Humans are still coming in contact with wild animals. Spillovers are happening. Outbreaks will be happening. Whether those outbreaks turn into epidemics and whether any of those epidemics turn into pandemics depends on what we do. It depends on whether we elect intelligent leaders who believe in science. It depends on whether we cooperate with public health advisories as citizens. It depends on our science and our technology to find these outbreaks before they turn into epidemics and pandemics. Here's the good news. We're smart. We're capable of a lot of things. We're an amazing species. We're capable of grandmaster chess and iambic pentameter and Major League Baseball and ballet. And we're capable of molecular biology. We can do it if we decide to do it. And I very much hope that we will. So I'll stop there.
You are listening to a Bozeman Public Library community forum featuring David Quammen with moderator Paula Beswick. Recorded by KGVM Bozeman on March 17th, 2021.
Wow, I'm not sure if I'm more frightened or more comforted. But thank you. Yeah. So maybe that's my first question.
For more than a year, Paula, maybe 10 years.
Yeah, that was going to say that was my first question to you. But while I'm scrolling through and we've got some questions for folks, I want to know, what was your first reaction when you learned about the SARS-CoV-2? And what did you think the implications were going to be for Bozeman?
I wasn't paying attention to this until January 13th of 2020. I belong to a list, an infectious disease list, email list called ProMed, and they send out 10 emails a day about different infectious disease events that are happening around the world. You know, there are mysterious goat deaths in Morocco. 80,000 of us get an email. A child has a fever after handling a pet chicken in Hong Kong. We get an email. Mostly I delete those emails. I got an email on January 13th from ProMed using the words novel coronavirus. That's the first time they said, this atypical pneumonia in Wuhan, China seems to be caused by a novel coronavirus. January 13th, 2020. That's when I perked up. And then the New York Times asked me about a week later, would you do an op-ed for us on whatever you want, maybe this virus in China? And I said, yes, I want to do it on this virus in China. So I wrote that for them. It was published on January 28th of last year. And it said, this virus could be coming soon to a town near you. And that included Bozeman. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for being the bellwether for us. So there's a couple of questions that have come in, and I'm going to aggregate them. But someone has said, should we be limiting or stopping wildlife trade, legal and illegal, to curb the future risk of pandemics? And then the other side of this is that WHO has come out, WHO has come out to say that they believe the virus might be from wildlife breeding facilities or farming. So there's those two sides of the coin of wildlife trade, wildlife animals, and then feeding farms.
Yeah, I'll answer the first question first and then help me remember what the second one was.
Okay.
Eliminate the wildlife trade depends on how you define wildlife trade. There is this phrase, bushmeat, people eating wild animals. And that phrase usually has sort of a negative onus to it. People talk about, well, there are people in Africa, they're eating bushmeat and they're getting these viruses. That's dangerous. There are people in China. In Montana, we call it game. Mm-hmm. And it's sacred to a lot of people. It's important to a lot of people. All animals carry viruses. So the wild animals in Montana carry viruses that could be dangerous to us. We know that they also carry other things like the chronic wasting disease prion, which is not a virus, that could be also dangerous to human health potentially. But wildlife trade, individual hunters hunting for their own table, that's not the wildlife trade. Wildlife trade is either harvesting wild animals for commercial sale, killing them for commercial sale, or capturing them in the live and bringing them to markets, or raising wild animals on farms and sending those farmed wild animals to markets. And in southern China, that includes things like bamboo rats and those civets that I was talking about, and ferret badgers and raccoon dogs, and these things that we've scarcely ever heard of that are farmed for food in China. Closing the capture of wild animals from the wild and bringing them to markets to be sold live next to other kinds of food, meat and seafood, closing that trade is a good idea. And China themselves, itself has already done that, or at least passed regulations decreeing that that should be done. Remains to be seen how well that's enforced. And that is a good move. Raising wild animals on farms for the market, just like raising red deer in New Zealand or raising elk on farms in Montana, has its own hygienic considerations, but it's not as dangerous as bringing live animals from the wild into markets alive. Now, the WHO team, those 10 scientists who went to Wuhan to investigate the origins of the virus, they only had 4 weeks there, and they spent 2 weeks of it quarantined in a hotel, and then another 2 weeks having meetings and visiting and touring labs. Two of those 10 people are friends of mine, and I've been talking to them about this, and two others are people that I've also interviewed or hope to interview soon. And what they're saying, as you pointed out, is that they suspect that, first of all, they discount the idea that this was a lab leak, that it leaked from Zheng Li Xi's lab, this virus. It's hard to prove a negative, but there is no positive proof whatsoever that that's what happened. And there is a lot of logic and proof suggesting that that is not at all what happened, that it came from the wild. But they suspect that, and they suspect that it came from a bat. But how did it get to Wuhan? Possibly the same way that SARS-1 got to the city of Shenzhen, which was in an intermediate animal. Maybe a bamboo rat. Maybe a bamboo rat that was being transported from one of those farms in southern China, including the one that I visited 10 years ago, where I had dinner, where I had a bamboo rat dinner with the proprietor of that bamboo rat farm. That's the hypothesis that's being referred to, that maybe it came from the wild animal farming trade. The viruses, similar to this coronavirus, that live in bats, that's all happening not in the province of Hubei, where Wuhan is. That's central China, but it's happening in southern China. So the question is, how did it get 1,000 miles from a bat in southern China to a food market in the city of Wuhan? And the suggestion is that it might have come by way of a farmed wild animal like a bamboo rat, and then infected a human, and possibly the human then carried it into that famous seafood market in Wuhan, and then the human became a super spreader and spread it to other people there. All that's hypothesis, but that's I would say that's the leading hypothesis at this point.
An alert attendee wants to know what happened to the Three Rivers.
Ah, thank you, alert attendee. See, that's why I announce these things at the beginning, so it will help my feeble memory. Okay, so what's the ultimate cause of this problem? It's not the wildlife trade. That's just one factor. It's human interaction, disruptive interaction with wild animals. It involves all the choices that we make, not just people in southern China, not just people in Africa, but all the choices that we make. What we eat, what we wear, what we buy, how much fossil fuel we burn, how much we travel, how many children we have, if we have children. All the consumer choices that we make is what brings viruses toward the from wild animals toward the human population. That problem is like a great river, the threat of pandemic disease, a great brown river. There are two other rivers running parallel to it. One of them is climate change, and the other one is the loss of biological diversity, which is a tragedy in its own right. These I think of as the three great rivers of trouble, the three riverine problems that we humans are facing and we humans are causing on this planet. Three big brown rushing rivers like the Yellowstone in June. Those rivers, it's not that climate change causes pandemic threats. There are some interactions, some channels braiding among those three rivers, but they're essentially flowing parallel, and they're flowing off a single snowfield on one great mountain. This snowfield is feeding these three rivers, and that snowfield is melting. Why is a snowfield melting? Because of things that we do, because of the force, the heat of human population size multiplied by consumption. Not just human population size, but human population size multiplied by individual human consumption, total human consumption. That multiplication yields a product, which is our heat on that great snowfield, causing these three rivers to flow. So we have to deal with them by dealing with the melting of that snowfield.
Well, that's a little scary. Okay, so what other families of viruses like coronaviruses should humanity watch out for?
The top of the list probably are the influenza viruses. People still have a tendency to take the flu for granted, but influenzas are can be very dangerous viruses. They can kill a lot of people. The 1918-1919 influenza, the so-called Spanish influenza, which didn't begin in Spain, is estimated to have killed 50 million people at a time when the human population was one quarter what it is now. Now, that toll probably involved bacterial infection as a secondary problem in a lot of those cases, as well as the virus itself. And we didn't have antibiotics in those days. But we are losing the efficacy of our antibiotics now because of acquired antibiotic resistance because of evolution and the overuse of antibiotics. So we can't depend on antibiotics necessarily totally in the future either. They do work. They are important. I don't want to keep people from going to the doctor. I don't want to scare anybody about vaccines or anything else. The medicine that we have now is science-based medicine. The antibiotics we have are science-based antibiotics. The vaccines, likewise, get them and use them. But when it comes to antibiotics, don't overuse them. That's another subject. Anyway, influenzas, a group called the paramyxoviruses, which nobody's heard of. That includes measles, mumps, rubella, and some other infectious viruses that can be serious to humans. So those three families of virus are at the top of the list. Keep them on your radar screen. Influenzas, coronaviruses, and paramyxoviruses.
So this question is similar to that, and maybe it's the paramyxovirus that you just said, but could grazing domestic livestock meant for human consumption on public lands near wild animals cause problems for us in the future?
Grazing domestic animals on lands also used by wildlife, yes, it could cause problems for us, and it could cause problems for wildlife too. Chronic wasting disease, the prion that causes that, if I remember the story correctly, came from an area outside of Fort Collins, Colorado, where, let's see, bighorn sheep were being kept for release back to the wild. And there had perhaps been domestic livestock on that same pasture, and they had perhaps carried this prion, and that was transferred to the bighorn sheep, and then the bighorn sheep were released to the wild. Don't hold me to that. That's just my best recollection of that story. But yes, absolutely. Domestic livestock on grazing lands, domestic livestock in giant feedlots. There were piggeries in northern Malaysia in which corrals with thousands of pigs were kept. And those piggeries were in an area where habitat had been destroyed that had once supported populations of giant fruit bats. And the fruit bats then needed to eat. The people who ran the pig farms planted mango trees and starfruit trees in the vicinity of their piggeries. In some cases, I think even shading their piggeries. The fruit bats came to the fruit trees, the domestic fruit trees. They sucked the sap out of the fruit. They dropped the pulp into the piggeries. If they were feeding on flowers for nectar, they dropped the flowers into the piggeries, and they were carrying a virus, now known as Nipah virus, that kills humans. It got into the pigs, and then it spread to pork farmers, pig farmers and pork dealers and pork butchers, and killed a bunch of people. So the nexus from humans to livestock to wild animals is a set of connections that are very significant for disease transfer, and it can go in either direction.
Okay, we are about out of time with you, so I want to end on two things. One, a positive note and wrap up from you. And then I see behind us, we both have the, you know, required or the prerequisite bookshelves in Zoom conversation. So I do want to know, you know, what are you reading these days? What can you recommend to us? What, you know, our favorite books or books that you go back to over and over again?
There's so many, I can hardly think of them. I'm going to go back to a lot of things over and over again. But one book that I have just finished reading that was very interesting and I highly recommend it is a book called Radical Hope, mm-hmm. Ethics in an Era of Cultural Devastation, I think is the subtitle, but Radical Hope. And it is about Chief Plenty Coup and the Crow people, their history, the catastrophic loss of lands that they went through, the hit that their culture took, and the way they moved through that with the help of the wisdom of Plenty Coup and survived and now continue to live on Crow Reservation, which is the core of, if I understand it, the core of their original lands. And according to this book, they are a success story of how radical hope can allow you to survive essentially virtually an Armageddon of your culture. And I read it because I've just sort of gotten back in touch with a fellow who was a friend of mine 51 years ago in college at Yale in 1960 and 1970. He's now a professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago, but he's very interested, and he writes about Aristotle, but he's very interested in the Crow people. And he wrote this wonderful little book, Radical Hope. So I asked him when I got back in touch, Jonathan, I'm not going to read Aristotle. I'm not going to read your scholarly philosophic works. What should I read? And he said, read my little book, Radical Hope. And I did, and I highly recommend it. I think it's one of the best books that I've ever read about Montana history.
Thank you so much for that. And so to wrap it up, what are your thoughts right now in terms of this pandemic and in terms of the coronavirus? And what for us?
My final thought involves a question I've been asking all the scientists that I interview, and I'm going to be interviewing another one in 27 minutes, an Italian woman in Florida who is a great disease scientist. And I'll ask her what I've asked others, including Tony Fauci. Do you think that this pandemic has been horrible enough, and by the time we get out of it, will have been horrible enough that we will learn from it and do what's necessary to be better prepared for the next one? And my own answer to that has been aided by reading my friend Jonathan's book, Radical Hope. I think that it's necessary for us to be hopeful, because unless we're hopeful, we don't imagine a better future where we are doing what's necessary to keep the earth green, to keep the earth diverse, to keep the earth healthy, to keep the earth from overheating. If we don't imagine that we can do it, then it won't happen. If we imagine that we can do it, there's a chance that it will happen. So I'm busy imagining, by way of radical hope, imagining that, yeah, we can do this. We can solve these problems.
Well, that does bring me comfort. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us for the first Library Community Forum. We're very excited that you could kick this off for us. And Beth has alerted me in the chat that Radical Hope is available at the library already.
Great.
So I'm sure that, you know, lots of people are suddenly now putting it on hold. So thank you very much for that. And as I bring on our next couple of panelists, you know, again, I want to thank you for joining us and thank you for sharing your knowledge and your wisdom and all of your research and your message of hope.
I'm really honored and glad to be part of this. I always want to be part of the Bozeman Library community and therefore the Library Community Forum. So thanks for inviting me.
You're listening to a Bozeman Public Library Community Forum featuring David Quammen with moderator Paula Beswick. Recorded by KGVM Bozeman on March 17th, 2021.
As David logs off, we have joined Gallatin County folks here. So joining us are Patrick Lonergan, Chief of Emergency Management and Fire for Gallatin County. And Patrick has worked in emergency services since 1995 with backgrounds in emergency management, structural and wildlife firefighting, emergency medical services, law enforcement, technical rescue, ski patrol, hazardous materials, and incident management teams. He is clearly a busy guy, so thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate that, Patrick. And with him is Mike Mulverna as Deputy Chief with Bozeman Fire Department. He participates as safety officer on the Gallatin Assist team, supporting local emergency services during incidents with public information support. Thanks to both of you so much for being with us today and taking time to talk to the library community. As a reminder to the attendees, please type your questions into the Q&A for Mike and Patrick. To start off, Mike and Patrick, I just want you to briefly explain your roles or the emergency team's role in managing this pandemic crisis, and then moving on to, you know, current news and data about COVID-19 and the vaccination process here in Gallatin County.
Sure. So I can go ahead and start that off. I'm Patrick Lonergan. I'm the Chief of Emergency Management Fire here in Gallatin County, and I'm working jointly with Mike Multivern as an incident commander to help manage the vaccination process taking place here in Gallatin County. And really, we're supporting all the COVID response, although the major activity that we're undertaking right now is working to get those that want to be vaccinated in our community vaccinated. So we're working on the operations we're running. We're working with our partner organizations around the community that are also providing vaccinations to the residents in the community here.
Great. And so where are we right now? Do you know current numbers of infected people and vaccinated people?
Sure, you bet. So the current numbers as of this morning, and all numbers in a fluid situation need to be taken with a grain of salt and recognize that there's a lag time there and they'll continue to change. But currently, on the statewide level, Montana has 101,760 cumulative cases that have occurred, with 1,040 active cases across the state, and 51 people hospitalized, and we're at 1,392 deaths. Here in Gallatin County, as of this morning, we're at 12,762 cumulative cases, with 153 active cases currently, one hospitalization, and 55 deaths. Kind of switching over since we're in the numbers for our vaccination side of the house. For state allocated vaccines that have come through the county and our other cooperating organizations, 23,015 first doses as of this week have been allocated to Gallatin County. And basically all those 23,015 doses have either been administered or are scheduled for an upcoming point of dispensing activity. And it should be noted that those are state allocated vaccines that have come through the state program. There are also some federally allocated vaccines that have been allocated through some federal programs directly to organizations in our community. So those are like long-term care facilities. Those are Veterans Administration activities to support veterans, as well as the federal pharmacy program that we're seeing start to flow into our community into various pharmacies.
So when we get the numbers of people who, you know, are quote unquote fully vaccinated, what does that mean? Does that mean second dose? Does that mean the 2 weeks after the second dose or the 2 weeks after the J&J?
So basically it means 2 weeks after whatever your last dose is. So whether that's a two dose or a single dose Johnson & Johnson, whatever vaccine you got, whatever vendor, it's 2 weeks after that last required dose.
Okay. Well, that's good to know because I keep hearing this fully vaccinated, and I've been wondering that personally of how does that work? And so what's Mike's role in this to get the information out and work with people?
Great. Thanks, Paula. So kind of like Patrick alluded to, early on last year, just over a year ago, we realized that the pandemic was going to definitely affect the state of Montana and of course, Gallatin County. And so as our health officer, Matt Kelly, and our board began to look at the challenges that we were going to face in the upcoming future, we decided that it was best to stand up some type of a response team to help deal with that, knowing that no one agency or entity throughout the county could possibly go through this process alone. So we stood up what we would call like an incident management team, and a group of managers came together, and we basically operate out of some county facilities, both the health department and our emergency operations center. And we stood up a team of people that had specific skill sets to bring something to the table. We've got people that specialize in logistics and people that specialize in the financial aspects, the planning process, the operations of what we're going to undertake. And so I share a role with Patrick, and we work together as the incident commanders. So we work under kind of a delegation authority through the health board and the health officer to help manage our response as a county for everything related to COVID. And of course, through the summer, most of that emphasis was placed on just the case counts themselves and contact tracing and notifications to the community and our public outreach. And then as of, you know, the fall, we started to shift towards the vaccination processes that, the vaccines themselves became approved by the FDA. And so then we shifted our kind of a strategic shift, if you will, to getting the community vaccinated. And so really my role is just communications and coordination with the managers as part of this team. And then there's a lot of outreach we do with the communities within the county and, you know, the school district and Montana State University and Bozeman Health and the clinics around town and organizations like CHP or Community Health Partners. And so there's just a lot of behind the scenes communications and coordination that go on to make sure that we're all on the same sheet of music. So that's kind of my role right now. And my day job is the deputy fire chief for the Bozeman Fire Department. And I've been in the community about 5 years and came from a community not far east of here and came with a skill set and some experience in running larger incidents. So Patrick and I function very well together. So that's been my role for the last year.
So you're fighting fires and putting out fires.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Figuratively, yes.
So question of, you know, how much testing is still happening in Gallatin County and also how much contact tracing is happening?
You know, so overall, our numbers are really trending in a positive direction. You know, we watch 7-day rolling averages. You know, the easy one for me is I look at our daily case count, if you will. And, you know, yesterday, for instance, we started the day off with 17 new cases. And that is a very, very manageable number for the system we have built. You know, if you were to look back to last spring, late spring, early summer, you know, we were getting over 100 new cases a day, and it became very, very difficult to keep up on. We had to adjust our contact tracing processes to scale that back a little bit. And we weren't able to give the individual people that were contracting the disease as much attention as we wanted to, just because we just didn't have the capacity for the numbers we were seeing. So we definitely like the numbers we're seeing today. We've been bouncing around that 20 mark a day. And yesterday, like I said, 17 was a really good number and very manageable. And so, and we think a number of different things are happening. You know, we keep inching towards that herd immunity. We have people being vaccinated in our community. So we're definitely moving in the right direction.
And how are you, both you and Patrick, or the emergency center there, working with MSU and the work that they're doing?
Yeah, we have a number of different interactions with them throughout the week. One to start with is we just do some basically reporting back and forth. So kind of for our situational awareness, we know what's going on with the university, and then same thing, they know with what's going on with the county health department. And, you know, they're kind of a community within a community up there. They do a very good job of managing their own population. So, but there's a lot of different places where we overlap. So it's good for us to be aware with what's going on with MSU and the same, and then being familiar with what we're doing. So we certainly share data. We share information about how many new cases they have. We share some testing numbers. And even a good example recently is we look at the points of dispensing that are going on throughout the community. They're doing a lot of their own vaccinations on campus. So we collectively, as a county, we request vaccine from the state once a week collaboratively. So all of our partners in the community, we share who's got pods coming up, how many vaccines we need to support those pods. And then we have one point of contact that reaches out to the state and says, Gallatin County is requesting 2,000 vaccines for the county for the upcoming pods for the next week. And then when those vaccines come to us, then we allocate them to support those pods that are scheduled. So there's a number of different interactions we share with Montana State. I would say we're probably on the phone or on a Zoom meeting with them probably 6 or 7 times a week.
And do you see that continuing in the fall, or do you think that there's going to be a need to continue to do that type of question?
Yeah, it started on a year ago by who our partners were going to be in the community, and that communication started immediately, and that has continued throughout, and it will continue until we're certainly on the other side of this pandemic.
Very good. I don't know if this is for you or for Patrick, but there was a question about the COVID long haulers. And is that something that you guys are keeping track of, those folks that continue to have symptoms, or is that just through the hospital? Or
define long haulers. I feel like I've heard that term, but.
Sure. It's the people who have had COVID that have these ongoing symptoms, whether it's the respiratory or the lungs or heart issues that we've been hearing about.
Definitely. We've heard both federally through the CDC, through state calls that we participate in, and even local evidence that we're hearing from the hospital that of those longer lasting, more lingering effects. And I can't speak to that much more. Probably better for a healthcare provider, like a physician, to talk about that. But we're definitely aware that, and we don't really know. You know, we're a year out from people contracting the disease, and we don't know what that's going to look like in terms of long-term healthcare. But yeah, we're definitely familiar with that, and that'd be a great question for a physician, probably.
Right. That's what I was just wondering, if anybody is tracking those numbers, because all these other numbers have been, you know, monitored so closely, and that's kind of this nebulous, area.
Yeah, I would say that's happening on a federal level through the CDC, and probably the state tracking some of those numbers. Locally, we haven't spent a great deal of time with that. Bozeman Health may be able to speak to some of that in terms of their recidivism at the hospital for COVID patients, but.
Okay. We have some questions about the actual vaccines. If you guys have, I don't know what the exact question is, but how do you feel about the one shot Johnson & Johnson, you know, versus the two shot Moderna, or also this, the new reports with the AstraZeneca, which of course we don't have here yet, but do you have any thoughts on those?
I'll kick that over to Patrick and we'll try to share this and team up on here.
Okay.
So first off, our disclaimer, we're not physicians or researchers that deal with that sort of thing. But I can tell you the general consensus amongst the providers here in the community, and that is that all of the three available vaccines that are available here in our state and our country are highly effective in terms of vaccinations. The Moderna and the Pfizer have some incredibly high numbers for how effective they are for vaccines overall. However, if you look at general vaccines in the whole world of vaccination, the Johnson & Johnson is also a highly effective vaccine in terms of how good it does at preventing hospitalizations and deaths. And when you compare the world of vaccination or vaccines, all three of them are considered highly, highly effective. The two-dose ones are using different technology than the Johnson & Johnson, and they have some incredible numbers. But when you look at what our goal is of vaccination, and that is to develop herd immunity, minimize the impact of those that do get it by keeping people out of the hospital and keeping people that do end up in the hospital from dying, all three of them are incredibly effective. And I know I've avoided trying to quote direct numbers there because I would get it wrong. I don't have them in front of me. But generally speaking, that is the consensus amongst those experts, is all three of them are highly effective, and you shouldn't think that any one of them is any lesser than the other three. They're just different in how they're designed a little bit. It's no different than, you buy a Chevy, a Dodge, or a Ford. They're going to have slightly different specs. They're going to be a little bit different. They might operate a little bit different, but ultimately all three of them are vehicles that can get you around the community. I just made that analogy up, so I don't know if it's a good one, but we'll go with it.
Well, I have a Chevy, so I don't know what that means. So do you know, or will you know, or when do you know which of the vaccines you're getting, which of the three, and what those numbers are?
Yeah, I can't quote the numbers for you, but the simple answer is we are receiving all three of the vaccines currently, not necessarily consistently. There's some logistical differences on how those are packaged and transported and how they can be divvied out. And the Pfizer, I'm sure people have heard, a tray of Pfizer and being, 1100 and some odd doses. Well, they have to come in those batches, and those Pfizer trays, they're a little harder to store. They're harder to drop because they have to be mixed with diluent, and they come in 1100 and some odd dose trays. So they're harder for smaller jurisdictions to deal with. As a result, because we do have a capability to deal with it, we have a larger population, we've been receiving a predominantly larger amount of Pfizer. However, we are receiving doses of Moderna, which is easier to hand off to some of our smaller partners. And we have gotten a few allocations, small allocations of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine also. So to answer your question, we're getting all three. It's all three of them behave differently. The scheduling on them is differently, and how you draw the dose is different. And so we try not to mix what we give. So if we're doing a point of distribution on a given day, it's going to be one set brand on that day, just because of the scheduling, if there's a second dose, how you draw it, the process is different. So largely speaking, Bozeman Health and Gallatin County are largely giving out Pfizer. At this point, we have a lot of Moderna early on, and then we're trying to hand off the Moderna to some of the smaller organizations, as well as some of the Johnson & Johnson.
When you say smaller organizations, you mean within the county?
Yes. Yeah. So like some of the points of dispensing taking place in West Yellowstone through the fire department and community health partners have largely been Moderna, because we can break it down into smaller batches for the size population and clinics they're doing, or like community health partners, some of those sorts of things. We've handed off some of the Johnson & Johnson to some of the urgent cares in town and a couple pharmacies. And again, it's way easier for us to schedule a follow-up dose than it is for a small pharmacy or a walk-in clinic. So it makes sense for those guys to do a single dose where they don't have to try and do follow-up scheduling of people.
That makes sense. So someone has asked if Gallatin County is getting fewer doses. Does it just seem like that than other counties? Is this being handled per capita?
So there's not an easy answer to that. And I mentioned it early on that the numbers in this situation are there's a lot of factors that go into them. And there's a lot of different ways to pull those numbers. And they don't necessarily mean the same thing, but they tend to get commingled. And so we need to be careful when we look at a given number compared to a different number and make sure we truly understand what we're looking at. To answer your question, there are communities that per capita have gotten more allocation than us, and there are some that per capita have gotten less allocation than us. Early on, there was a super big discrepancy, but there were some differences when we were in the phase 1A population, when we were dealing with those healthcare workers. When you look at some of the other communities that have much larger medical facilities and they have, you know, maybe two major hospitals in their community. And so that really skewed the numbers early on. What we found when you split off that phase 1A population and you look at the 1B and the 1B plus populations, our numbers are a lot more leveled out. It's not exact. It's not going to be exact of how those medications get sent around or the vaccines get allocated. But when you actually look at what's happening, it is fairer and more distributed than it sometimes appears when you look at the surface. We also have to remember that some of these communities have other suppliers and programs putting vaccinations into their community. So you look at some of these communities that have reservations around them, or maybe they have a really large elderly population in assisted living facilities, or maybe they have a military population or a lot of retired military being serviced by Veterans Administration. And that's when I talk about mixing of the numbers. When you look at some of the statistics that the state is putting out, they're showing state allocations allocated by them, not the other federal programs. However, their vaccinations administered is based on where people said they lived. So when we look at Gallatin County and we talk about, you know, our population of people that work here, like in public safety and healthcare, you know, there's a lot of people that maybe work at the hospital in Park County or they live in Broadwater County. And we vaccinated them with our supply because they're our 1A workforce that works here, but they may not live here. So that vaccination got credited as a vaccination in Park County or Broadwater County or wherever they live. And so it's really hard to say this shot came from here and it went to here because of all those factors. And conversely, those federal programs, they don't show as allocations to us, but yet they show as a vaccination because they get registered in the state system and it shows the vaccination wherever they say they live. So you look at some of these other communities, let's say like Cascade County, where I would assume there's a lot of retired military personnel at the Air Force base, they very well may see a lot higher number of people showing vaccinated because they may have gotten it through the Veterans Administration that didn't show up an allocation, but it shows as a vaccination. So I guess, and there's a lot of other factors that go into that we don't want to get into. My message is, yeah, well, we can take more vaccine. We have more capacity to administer more vaccine here in Gallatin County. And whatever we are allocated and sent to us, we will administer quickly to our community. But I don't know that the discrepancy between other counties and our county is as large as it sometimes looks.
Thanks for explaining that as best as you could without overwhelming us.
There's no simple answer to it. It's complex, surprisingly so.
Okay, so here's another complex one for you, and we're about nearing our time to end, so this is good. But can you predict worst case and best case timelines to vaccinate the county to an adequate level, given our 110,000 population that's here now.
Yeah, and just like your last answer, obviously that's a very, very complex question. I would say we're very forward-looking. We're very positive here. We have certainly, with what we started out seeing in allocations for vaccine coming into Gallant County, we're seeing those numbers climb. We feel like we're working through our population in a very effective and efficient manner. We're doing it safely. It all indications point that those allocations are going to continue to climb. We're going to get more vaccine coming to Gallant County. We're prepared for that. We've built systems and programs to give all the allocations that we can get. So I would say, and this is Mike Maltaverne's crystal ball, I would say by probably midsummer, I'm going to feel really, really good about where we are as a community and as a county. That's me. I have really nothing to back that up other than a feeling I get with the amount of vaccine that's coming into our county and our ability to get it out the door and get it into arms is we're highly effective right now. And we continue to request more. And sometimes we get more and sometimes we don't. But also looking federally, you look at the amount of vaccine that's being produced is also going up. We've got a president that's very actively requesting more and more be manufactured by the drug manufacturers, and those requests are being answered. And so we're starting to see that trickle down effect through the states and into the county. So I would say by midsummer, back to that herd immunity and getting, you know, we've had a lot of people in our community that have either contracted the disease or they've been vaccinated. And so we're going to continue to work with the population and I'm going to feel very good, by early to midsummer.
Do you have a percentage of the population, a number that is, you know, you're shooting for to consider it?
You know, I'd love to. That's a moving target, because what we don't know is we have 114,000 people, kind of unofficially that reside in Gallant County. Those are the numbers that we use. Those are some planning assumptions that we make based on some census data. So 114,000 people. What I can't put my finger on is the percentage of those 114,000 people that will want to sign up for a vaccination. We don't know that. It's a moving target. And you know, we've seen some information coming out nationally, what some projections are of what the population, percentage of the population that's going to want to get vaccinated. But that's a really, really tough number to wrestle with. And so to guess would be nothing better than that. We just don't know. And that's all it could be religious beliefs. It could be political viewpoints. It could be, you know, if I live in a rural part of the county and I have little to no interaction with the public, it may not be a priority for me if I'm a farmer or a rancher, if I live out in a rural area, or if I live in a nursing home, my life may depend on getting that vaccine. So that's a very difficult question, and I just don't have an answer for that.
I can give you a couple numbers. So, and it tags on to Mike's point. So the state estimates that eligible people, so those are basically people over 16 years of age in the county, because you can't get the vaccine if you're less than 16. And depending on the vendor, you might be 18. There's about 89,000 people is kind of who they're saying could be eligible. And then you get into the question that Mike hit up of what's the uptake? Who actually wants that out of the 89,000 people?
Good. Well, thank you for clarifying that. So the last question, because I know we're a little bit running over, and this, is one that you can maybe end with a note of hope too, to say that, you know, what, you know, people in their 60s and 70s, so, you know, in the first 1A and 1B plus group that's out there now that haven't been able to get vaccinated, you know, maybe they haven't been able to sign up, or, you know, it fills up very quickly. What should they do, and what can we predict for that group?
So even as late as this week, right, we've got direction from the governor's office now. Here in a couple of weeks, he's going to open it up and he's going to make everybody eligible, right? The challenge there is we still have a pretty good segment of our 1B population that is still trying to get signed up for a vaccine. It's an extremely competitive process. We're trying to open multiple doors for somebody who's eligible to get scheduled for a shot. And so our dilemma here is, if we open it up to the general population, if everyone's eligible now, how do we strategically go back and give the vaccine to those that are most at risk? And so we've got a meeting scheduled for the 23rd coming up with a community task force that we've assembled. Those are just stakeholders, people that represent all different populations and demographics in our community. We're going to meet with them in a few days, and we're going to discuss this movement into this, everyone's eligible phase coming up the first of the month. So we're going to look for a little bit of guidance from them. We're going to bounce this off of them and see, do we try to wrestle with that, continuing to try to give the shots or prioritize those that are most at risk or of that age group? Or do we just make it, completely open and everybody's eligible? There's a dilemma with that. There's a reason that we began with this prioritization and this phasing of our population, right? Because what we saw is those are the people that are getting sick, and those are the people that are being hospitalized, and ultimately those are the people that are dying, are the most at risk. So it's a dilemma that we're going to have to face here as a local community and local jurisdiction. And so we're going to reach out to this group of stakeholders and bounce the idea off of them and see what comes back. And hopefully they'll be able to help us and maybe provide a little direction and what that looks like moving forward. So it's challenging, because one of the challenges is getting that appointment. And there's been some technology that's been made available through the state. And some of that technology is very difficult for that aged population, those folks that are over 60, over 70, over 80. And so there's a technology challenge for them. And if we open it up to everybody over the age of 16, it's only going to increase the competition, and we don't have the supply yet to meet that increased demand. So it's a challenge. And also there's a moral dilemma. If I'm 50 years old and now all of a sudden, 1st of April, I'm eligible, should I sign up and take a shot before somebody who's 75 and more at risk than I am? So it's going to play on my conscience. What do I decide? We have some tough decisions coming up as a community and as a health department.
Do you guys get advance notice from the governor's office? I noticed, I just read yesterday that he had the press release. How do you deal with that?
it's been sometimes yes and sometimes no, to be completely honest with you. Sometimes we watch we watch press conferences just like the general public, and we learn at that time. And sometimes we'll get some notification of what's coming down the pipe.
Well, thank you guys so much. I know you have a very difficult job, and I appreciate you taking time to meet with us and to put some clarity to our process going on here. It's very valuable to learn more about this. So thank you so much.
So Paul, I just have to thank you for putting this together and the library supporting this forum. I can tell you one of our biggest challenges has been community outreach and disseminating good information as quick as we get it. There's so much misinformation out there and lack of information, and it's very confusing and very complex. And so these opportunities that we get to share what's going on with the community is extremely valuable, and be able to answer questions coming from the field. And so thank you for putting this together. We really appreciate it.
Good. Well, thank you. Yeah, I think we got a good lesson today from the global perspective with David Quammen down to the local. So I'm getting lots of thank yous coming in. So I want to share those with you guys as well. And again, hey, get back to work. You guys are busy.
And just, please feel free, if there's outlying questions out there, feel free to go to the county's website, funnel those through readygallatin.com, get them the right people. We'll try to respond to them. But okay. We've got multiple different venues to try to reach out to people, with public information officers. We work very closely with the media and the like. So we'll work at it.
Great. Perfect. Thank you. Thank you for your service. We really appreciate it.
You are listening to a Bozeman Public Library community forum featuring David Quammen with moderator Paula Beswick. Recorded by KGVM Bozeman on March 17th, 2021.